Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, debate, dialogue, discussion, answers to your emails and questions about healthcare and science in the news. Before we go any further, let me remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Something recent caught my eye. This was absolute total news to me, so I wanted to bring it to your attention. Researchers reported in a recent copy of the American Journal of Medicine that an association between the use of acetaminophen and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs with hearing loss. And we're talking about long-term, low-level use, which is quite different than an overdose situation. This study looked at 26,000 men, mostly Caucasian, and they were from 40 to 75 years old at enrollment back in 1986. So every 2 years, they would fill out a questionnaire about their use of various drugs, lifestyle factors, and the people doing the research have been following along and discovered a strong association between the use of acetaminophen more than twice a week doubles the risk of hearing loss. Now, that's a significant increase, doubling the risk of hearing loss. The increases were greater for acetaminophen than for ibuprofen or aspirin. Aspirin increased hearing loss by 30%, anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen by about 60%, but acetaminophen by a whopping 200%. So that's a sit up and take notice kind of finding. Mechanism, I'm not sure. I've certainly not been in the habit of thinking of acetaminophen as an agent that damages those hair cells, but apparently it is. So something we all need to think about and perhaps try to limit and rotate might be the actual best thing to do. Don't have a favorite painkiller, but in fact rotate your painkillers if you need to use them on a regular basis. Let's clarify the acetaminophen story a bit. At the request of my producer, yes, it was just acetaminophen, not with anything else. People who used it for pain twice a week or more had double the risk in the long term of hearing loss. And we're going to go straight to a caller, Larry in Atlanta, Georgia. Hello, Larry.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, my pleasure, Larry. What can I do for you?
I happen to be 61 years young, in good health overall. I have no insurance. Now, having said that, about 4 weeks ago, give or take, as the crow flies, I was trying to open a tin can, and I accidentally jammed my thumb into the jagged edge of the tin can.
Ouch.
Well, at that point, what I did, I know, thumb accident, long story very short, so I went to my local discount, store, big box store, and I got some generic antibacterial cream, bandaged and wrapped it up. Well, hoping that all that would take care of it, my thumb became swollen, and so got me kind of scared. So I found out about a local clinic in town, a nurse practitioner, who told me that in her opinion, I happened to have cut my tendon.
Ooh,
which got me very scared. At that point, we found a doctor who would work with me because of the no insurance. He looked at me and he said, listen, Larry, can you move your thumb? I said, I can. I can move my thumb somewhat. I can do that. My problem is, Dr. Dawn, is I can't move it all the way to my palm. If I force it, it hurts. Now, the doctor, surgeon, and who does hands also told me that if I actually sever the tendon, I couldn't move my thumb at all, period. What he said was basically is he thought maybe 3 or 4 months, my body would heal itself, and my thumb would be okay. The actual cut is healed.
Okay.
I have kind of a lump where I cut myself, and again, my thumb's still swollen. What do you think?
Well, let me ask the question that you didn't ask, but let me make sure this is your question. I think
yes.
The question you're asking me is the guy who told me that if I'd cut the tendon, I wouldn't be able to move it correct? And the question number two is, can I expect that this will just heal eventually? Are those your questions?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So let's take number one. You could have partially cut a tendon, not completely. If you cut it all the way through, you can't move the thumb. That's absolutely true. No argument with that. If you've got a partial cut of something, then you can move it, but it's a little bit weak, and you may get a kind of sense of, I don't want to go there. Not just pain, but what we call apprehension, which is where it's sort of a body awareness of what the stretch receptors are saying, and they're saying, you know, don't push it. So you listen to those don't push it's. But a partially ruptured tendon or cut, ruptured either way, if it's partial, it will knit. And your time frame on complete knitting for a tendon is a long time. It's about twice as long as it takes to heal a bone. So call it 3 months. That's for a tendon to get back to strength. So when we repair them, we basically tell people, you know, you don't put a load on this for 3 months. And then, of course, if you put a massive load on it, you could still rupture it. But trying to use the thumb passively to make sure that you keep your range of motion. So that movement that hurts when you do it, moving it towards the palm, if you use your other hand to make that movement, does it hurt in the same way?
Not at all. No, not at all.
Okay. So what I think that means is that you probably did cut into the tendon and it's healing because you can still move it. And you want to make sure that you do move it passively back and forth so that you keep the range of motion. And after you cut something deep like that, it's not uncommon to continue to have swelling persistently for months and soreness persistently for months. And the only thing that one would worry about would be if you had a retained foreign body deep, like a piece of the can actually came off in your hand. And that's unlikely, but the way that will behave is it'll continue to hurt and it'll actually eventually start coming to a head and trying to drain pus. And if you see that, then you have to go in looking for a foreign body. Since it's a metallic foreign body we're worried about, a simple x-ray would probably tell you if that was there. But given that you don't have health insurance, that $100 for that x-ray is probably not worth it. You can observe and see how your hand behaves.
Back to the x-ray, I asked the doctor, if you broke down a piece of glass, I'd say, you know, we need to get the x-ray. However, as you said, you know, and he confirmed it, since it's a tin can, more than likely it was not broken. So what he said, listen, what we can do is hold off on the x-ray and save you some money at this point.
Yeah.
I guess my only other question to you very quickly is, as another doctor told me, if I in fact tear for the tendon or damaged it, right, what he told me is the longer I wait, more difficult it would become to heal or to surgically correct.
If you can still move it, then you don't need a surgical repair.
Good.
Okay.
Good.
So good luck to you, Larry, and I'm going to take our next caller now, but I wanted to just point out, imagine for the other listeners, this is what we need in this country, is we need people like yourself who are 60 years old and hurt themselves to have access to health care without worrying about breaking the bank. This is, you know, what the debate is all about, is including all these people who are currently left out of the system or at a financial, huge financial risk should something like simple like this happen. So thank you very much for being an absolute example of why we need health care reform.
Doctor, God bless. Thank you so much.
Have a good day. Bye-bye. Let's go now to Anne in Santa Cruz. Hello, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I have another hand problem.
Wow.
A little different. I have trigger thumb, I believe. When I bend my thumb, it catches and then it pops.
Yeah.
So it just has this funny sort of popping.
Mm-hmm. Does it ever get really stuck?
It hasn't gotten really stuck, although it has gotten worse. It has gone away completely for like an hour, and then sometimes, especially in the morning, it can be really bad, and then it gets better, and then during the day, it kind of stays the same. It's annoying, mm-hmm. and it hurts a little bit when it pops.
Is this your dominant hand?
No, it's my left hand.
Okay.
So I went to the doctor about it, and she sent me to physical therapy, which I didn't think did anything. I wore a brace for a while, and that didn't seem to do anything. Mm-hmm. And now I've noticed that there's a very hard, small, pointed lump mm-hmm. below my index finger.
Below your index finger?
Yes.
You're forming lumps on your tendons. So why are you forming
that
lumps?
That doesn't sound good.
Well, it could be from trauma. So are you doing things that are stressing the palm of your hand. Well, let's see, weightlifting,
no.
Mountain biking,
no.
A round tool, forcefully, jewelry making, pliers. I'm just throwing things out there. You need to go and think, what am I doing that's using the pads of my hand hard? If there isn't anything, then a couple of things. One of which is get yourself some bicycle gloves with the padded palms and use them when you do housework. Or when you ride your bicycle, just protect the palms of your hands. It's just prevention to keep from getting more.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have an obvious source of trauma, then it's bad DNA. So now we're looking at something that's going to keep happening to you.
Mm-hmm.
This is more common in diabetics, but it's common with aging. And there is, in my view, an association with trauma, but it's not absolute, and some people just get it. The lumps on the tendons are a problem if they're in the wrong place. If they're not in the wrong place and they're in a length of tendon where there's not a little tunnel that the tendon has to run through, then you're just stuck with a lump that you can feel, but it's not going to trigger on you. It's not going to become a trigger finger. On the other hand, if it's in a bad spot, like evidently the one in your thumb is, it gets caught as it moves through the tendon sheath. If you didn't have these tendon sheaths, you would get what's called bowstringing, which means when you tighten the muscle, the skin would lift up because the tendon would essentially go the path of least resistance, which is the shortest distance between two points, and that would stretch your skin out, but it wouldn't move your finger very much. So these tendon sheaths bind the tendon to the bone so that when you flex the tendon, the bones actually move rather than the skin moving. But if there's a lump and the tendon can't move through the arch, think of it as a little arch or tunnel, then you get stuck. I usually, at this point with a patient, would either inject a little cortisone into the lump. If I could feel it, I would try injection. Or if the person didn't want to go with cortisone, I would use little tiny acupuncture needles. And what I'm trying to do there is anti-inflammation, figuring that, okay, some of this is swelling, and if I can get the swelling to go down, I can maybe reduce the size of the lump by the 0.2 millimeter that I need so that it'll now slide back and forth through that sheath.
Mm-hmm.
So you just have a little tightness. It's not locking on you yet, so you've got movement but drag. So now what we want to do is get the swelling down, and maybe that'll do it for you. Over long periods of time, if they recur, then people do a surgery where they just cut open that particular tunnel. Because it turns out that you've got redundancy in the system, so you can open up the tunnel and not lose any function, or you can get in there and shave down the lump. And depending upon the particular location, and the surgeon may choose to do one or the other or both of those.
So would ice help for the inflammation?
Sure, give it a shot. Ice strengthens things. It causes decreased blood flow. And we have very narrow tolerances in our hands. Just personal example, I've been doing a lot of wedging clay because I do ceramics in my free time. And this morning, driving to work, I said, oh my goodness, I have carpal tunnel in my left wrist because I spent too much time wedging yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happens with the hands. We have very narrow tolerances, and a little bit of swelling is enough to, in the case of my situation, push on my median nerve a little bit. It'll be better in a day or two, and yes, I'm going to ice my wrist when I get a chance today.
Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is if there's anything that I should do now to keep things worse from happening later.
Yes, that's the padding that I already spoke of.
Okay.
So you protect your hands. Don't subject the padding to a lot of trauma. Don't pound on your hands.
Mm-hmm. And I got a thumb spica, which does not keep my thumb from bending and hitting that trigger that's popping.
You need to keep it from popping in order to have any effect at all.
Okay, so I need to keep it from popping.
Yeah, the thumb spica isn't working. There's various things you can do. You can extend the thumb part. There are other kinds of little braces you can get that just hold the thumb in extension. So, you know, it gives you kind of a hitchhiker pose, but doesn't affect the wrist. So I would play around with different kinds of braces and splints. The kind of splints you might use for a broken finger might do the job, for example.
Okay.
And see what you get.
And one last question. would it be worth going to physical therapy for electrical stimulation and or the, I don't know what you call it, sonic something or other?
Well, I don't know. I guess there's a tendency to, pardon the pun, try to push physical therapy in a circumstance like this because you don't want to just not do something. I'd be a little worried that it would get worse because of increasing swelling from the activity.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not aware that any of the modalities you've mentioned actually reduce swelling or inflammation.
Yeah.
Mostly pain control modalities, in my understanding.
Uh-huh.
Now, this may just be my ignorance talking, and if anyone knows better, please call in and teach me something. But I don't know. I don't think it strikes me as where I would go first.
Oh, good. Because it didn't seem like it was doing anything.
Wasting time.
And wasting time, yes.
Wasting time spending money supporting the medical industrial complex.
Yeah.
But not necessarily helping you.
Right. Exactly.
All right.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay,
bye-bye. As requested, we did get an off-air from a physical therapist regarding the trigger finger question who said pulsed ultrasound treatment can reduce swelling. So there you have it from a physical therapist, a thought that, yes, indeed, some of the ultrasound modalities might reduce the swelling and have a benefit. So obviously, one can try it and see. Had an interesting email that I wanted to share with you from Rod in Wisconsin about D-ribose. I started on Lipitor in 2003 along with Plavix and blood pressure meds. These meds were given to me because I had a stent put in the back main vessel of my heart because I was having arm pain. So he goes on to tell me that he has made a lot of changes in his life, reducing stress, changing his diet, and in the last 4 or 5 years, he had started noticing hand pain in his joints and also more pain in his back and his shoulder, upper and lower back. He was told this wasn't due to his Lipitor, which he was put on for the stent, but it did seem worse in the morning. And he stopped his Lipitor and his pain didn't get any better. So he had kind of given up on it, went back on his Lipitor, and then he listened to our podcast about chronic fatigue syndrome, and the doctor mentioned that he gave D-ribose to some of his patients, and they had more energy. So he started taking D-ribose, 5 milligrams, 3 times a day, and he had a remarkable shift in his muscle pain and his hand pain. So he has been taking D-ribose at a dose of 5 milligrams, 3 or 4 times a day, and he finds that if he does forget to take his dose and starts to get pain, the ribose will take the pain away quite quickly. So he's wondering, should he be doing something else besides the D-ribose? And he has been off the Lipitor because he was able to get his cholesterol numbers down with diet. So bravo to you on that, Rod. And I found your email intriguing because obviously, you were not expecting you would get some kind of miraculous improvement with the D-ribose. You tried it on spec. So the fact that you had such a distinct change, I think, is quite significant. And it tells me that your pain was actually due to a problem with energy generation in your cells. A problem, in other words, making ATP. The reason that D-ribose is helpful is because it's a 5-carbon sugar. Adenosine, which is what your ATP is made of, is adenosine triphosphate, is ATP. And adenosine is actually kind of hard to make. Their cells have a desire to take one phosphate off, the ATP becomes ADP, and then recycle that into ATP. But in a situation where the body is really starved for energy, it'll take that second phosphate off, taking the ADP to AMP from diphosphate to monophosphate. And at that point, the monophosphate can't be recycled. It's a waste product. And so you have to start all over and take the ribose, make adenosine, and then start adding the phosphates on it. It's a peculiarity of our physiology. Ribose is used a lot of times by athletes. And it's also recommended for heart disease patients because many heart disease patients have problems with energy generation in those very demanding muscle cells of the heart. So I would recommend in your situation that you might also want to take CoQ10, which I always tell my patients on statins to use, And you might also consider using something called L-carnitine. L-carnitine is an amino acid, but it has a property of helping move the fat diglycerides into the mitochondria so that they can be broken down and burnt. So you can burn either glucose and sugar molecules, or you can burn fat molecules. And the fat molecules come in as acetyl-CoA, and that gets transported by the L-carnitine. So the bottom line is, raise the L-carnitine, you raise the transport of fat molecules into the mitochondria, which can then burn those as an alternative fuel, and you improve the energy generation of the cell. So hope that wasn't too much physiology for you there. Another email, this one from Tiziano in San Juan Bautista. And Tiziano writes in, I love your show and I'm always interested when you talk about diabetes. On Saturday, you spoke about this particular acid. I am type 2 and I've been on metformin for many years. My doctor just upped my dose to 2,000 milligrams per day. Can I use this acid to assist as well as using cinnamon and celery? Also, raw almonds seem to drop my sugars quite well after a good night's rest. Thank you. So, Tiziano, alpha-lipoic acid is the acid that we were talking about there. It's an antioxidant, and doses of up to 400 milligrams twice a day are very helpful for diabetic neuropathy, and we know that from double-blinded studies. But it also acts like the drugs that we use to sensitize the insulin receptors. It's a PPAR agonist. And so Avandia and Actos are the two drugs you may have seen advertised for diabetes that have the same mechanism of action. This is a natural and, I might add, considerably cheaper way to get a similar effect. However, if you are taking alpha-lipoic acid twice a day, you want to be using biotin, which is a B vitamin, 10 milligrams a day, because the alpha-lipoic acid depletes you of biotin. So it's important to take those two in combination if you're taking them long term. And a good B complex never hurt anybody. So I would say all of the B vitamins are a good idea. Since you mentioned that almonds tend to help drop your sugars, I wanted to mention to you that walnuts as well are very effective. And I haven't said this enough, and so let me just state that if you are going to be consuming nuts as a diabetic, you should keep them in the refrigerator, because nuts do go rancid, and the oil, once they develop some rancidity, actually is a potent oxidant. And so you don't want to increase your oxidative stress while you're trying to improve your diabetic control. And we're going to Lori in Santa Cruz. Hello, Lori, and welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I had a question about, I have herpes oral simplex 1, and after being with my boyfriend for 3 years, he finally succumbed with a vengeance. It's just been incredible. At first, he didn't have the blisters on his lips. He just had, like, the achy joint sort of stuff that happens, you know, initially, but eventually got blisters inside his lip and in his nose, and also was having, like, bleeding gums and stuff. Is that?
Yeah.
You ever heard of anything like that?
Oh, yeah, but it usually you see that in children when they get their first attack of oral herpes.
Uh-huh.
He has gotten to be an adult without ever being exposed to oral herpes. And that's unusual. Most of us get little exposures in childhood from, you know, Aunt Bertha's big wet smackaroo right on our face. And so we get little attacks, or maybe in some cases, in pediatric cases, you'll get a really fulminant case. And yeah, you'll get it on the tongue, the gums, the cheeks, and gums will bleed. It's very fierce.
Yeah.
And then later on, you really only get herpes on the lips and maybe the tongue. It's rare to see it on the roof of the mouth or the inside of the cheeks in your second, third, fourth, fifth outbreak. Same with the nostrils, although that one can recur. The thing you worry about with the nostrils is that it can get super infected with bacteria, and that will look very similar, except it just won't clear up. So if the nose stuff is lasting more than a week, I would definitely get that cultured and make sure it hasn't started growing Staph aureus, which would be the opportunistic affection that would get in there.
it's been about I'd say 12 days already, and he's looking a lot better. He's feeling better.
Did he get treated?
No.
Because the drugs that we use for genital herpes will work very well for oral herpes. So I'm sorry he didn't get to a doctor, because drugs like Zovirax or Famvir or Valtrex are really helpful.
Oh, okay.
In this circumstance.
Uh-huh.
So it's unfortunate that he got such a severe case. I'm sorry to hear that.
He's just real reticent to go anywhere and just didn't feel like doing anything. So.
Yeah, just kind of went into the man cave.
Huh?
I said he probably retreated into the man cave and just licked his wounds, so to speak.
Yes.
Well, I'm glad he's feeling better now. Any other questions about that?
I mean, what I know, just wondering if you can add to it about, you know, how to deal with herpes in the future and stuff. Just, I've found lysine, dosing with lysine is just really helps to...
Doesn't help everybody, but I, anecdotally, there's definitely responders. So I figure it doesn't hurt to take the extra lysine. Be sure that you don't take that with your only protein meal of the day.
Uh-huh.
If you don't eat a lot of protein, because you will interfere with the absorption of, among other things, arginine, because of the way amino acids are absorbed.
Uh-huh.
So, okay. Just a little trick there. Thank you very much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Judy in Capitola. Hello, Judy. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. I'm 67 and fair-skinned Anglo-Saxon. And I have really thin skin on the back of my hands. It's like tissue paper.
Mm-hmm.
I try to protect it, you know, with gloves and stuff like that. And sometimes it just gets torn and I don't even know it. But I'm wondering if there's something topical or dietary I can add to strengthen that a little bit.
Well, not dietary, but I will recommend for this use of vitamin K. You're not on blood thinners because of a history of pulmonary embolism or something, right?
No.
Then you can use topical vitamin K. And there's a couple of different makers of that. Dermal K is one brand that I've heard and seen. This will cause a little bit of strengthening and a little less bruising.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe there's any clinical studies, but people keep buying it, so presumably they think it works.
Yeah, well, it tears, and then if I hit my hand or even somebody grabs it really tightly, it'll bleed. I get a big
bruise,
bleeding underneath. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And essentially, that's from ultraviolet damage over the years.
Yeah, I would think so. I never was, much of an outdoor sunbather, but just your hands are just out there.
You're in the world, and particularly if you're washing them, it's very hard to prevent the damage to the back of the hands.
Yeah.
The skin there, it starts out fairly thin, and as it degrades, you lose the elastic layer.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it less stretchy, which means it's more likely to tear when it's sheared rather than just stretch and rebound.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you lose the supportive collagen matrix that is also there to keep the skin firm and protected. There's really nothing you can do to rebuild that.
Mm-hmm.
Even pulse laser or something that might be done on the face for rejuvenation doesn't seem to give you very good results on that. Vitamin C is helpful. Copper is good, although I wouldn't put copper in my mouth for that, because if it's the problem with the immune system and copper and zinc, I would probably use a copper cream.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there is a couple of, you know, facial rejuvenation creams out there, the ones containing extra vitamin C in an esterified form and the ones containing copper, that have some validity in the fact that they can help build collagen.
Oh.
So it might be worth using both of those. You know, these are over-the-counter products. I think Oil of Olay or somebody has a copper-based one, or Cody or one of those, drugstore brands. And there's a product called Siesta, which is sold for wrinkles, that has vitamin C in a form that would absorb through your skin.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be a way of delivering the copper and the vitamin C and the vitamin K. And those will benefit you. I don't know how much, but you might give it a try on one hand.
Okay.
Because, you know, I'm talking about probably $40 or $50 worth of product.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you'd be spending that, trying it, and I would test one hand and see if you notice an improvement after a month or so.
Okay. All right, thank you very much.
Good luck. Let me know how it turns out.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And that's always good advice, by the way. I tend to do that when I'm testing a product on myself, is treat one side and use my other side as a control, and that can be a useful thing sometimes you really can't discern a difference, and it's like, okay, I'm not going to buy another bottle. Let's go to Marlena in Santa Cruz.
Hello. Thank you, doctor, for taking my call. I wanted to say thank you so much. You changed my life, diabetes, by recommending that wonderful author, Dr. Bernstein. I have bought his books. I am on his website, and he is wonderful.
I agree.
And so I was listening to your show this morning, and you were speaking again about diabetes. And could you spell the name of that product you mentioned to the woman to help her? It was something with acid in it.
Right. It's alpha, like A-L-P-H-A, lipoic, yes. L-I-P-O-I-C, acid, three words. And you'll often see it abbreviated as capital A, capital L, capital A.
Alpha lipoic acid. I get it. Now, the other thing is that I have found another book called Connecting the Dots by Leonard Dedo, and he is almost like someone who follows Bernstein's method, and it's a for more like for a lay person.
Okay.
So I wanted to recommend that to you.
And how then, do you spell that name?
Dedo. D-E-D-D-O.
All right. I got it. I will look up that book, maybe check a segment of it, and report back to my audience whether I agree that it's a really good book or not.
And now, the only thing I'm having trouble with, I love Bernstein because he's saying, you know, try to be like a normal person, even though you have a blood sugar issue. You know, he says, stay within 70 to 105 fasting, and after 2 hours meal, it should be less than 120. That's my goal. The doctors or the diabetic society sort of makes the numbers, buffers the numbers a little bit for diabetes people.
I agree. And I also think that by making the numbers higher, we sort of create a self-fulfilling prophecy of progression of the diabetes.
Exactly. So I am trying to keep within those numbers. But what is happening with me, and I'm sure that a lot of people have this problem, is I just love the food I shouldn't eat. And, you know, I've done all the diets, and it's just like a battle.
Well, what I do with my diabetic patients who are having this difficulty is I give them some immediate release insulin. And there's a couple of products now that come in these really nice little pens, cartridge pens, so you don't need to be dealing with a syringe. That makes it really doable for people. And the way I work it is we figure out what dose of insulin you need so that you can have your piece of cake or your piece of pie or your dessert or your bowl of pasta. And we do that by testing your system. And effectively, what people end up with after we've done this is they end up with a little card they can pull out that says, if this is 250 carbohydrates, calories, then you need 5 units before you eat it. And then a person will give themselves a 5-unit immediate acting insulin shot and eat their pasta. And then an hour later, check their blood sugar. And if it's elevated, and I usually will use 150 as a threshold, but you could use 120, give themselves another unit or two, then they know next time, instead of 5 units, it's 7 units for that much pasta. And having 2 or 3 favorite foods is typical that you just really miss. And I find that what people do is they don't go crazy with it, because if they have to give themselves a shot, that really kind of acts like a counter conditioning, and it's a hassle. So that they just sort of go, okay, I really want this pasta, so I'll do the shot this time. But the other time when they might have done the pasta, they just say, you know, it's not worth it to me right now to take the time to do this. But it does free you up and give you control.
Now, are you talking about type 2? Because I
don't... I am talking about type 2 diabetes, because if you really want to eat those foods, then you need to take insulin in order to eat those foods. So it's your call.
Okay.
So it's your call. It's going to be, you're going to have to learn to use the insulin. You're going to have to go through this rigmarole of establishing your dose response curve, but then you are free to indulge. Don't encourage you to do it every day.
But not too much.
But it does allow you literally to have your cake and eat it too and still be a well-controlled diabetic.
Thank you so much. You have a great show, and you are so knowledgeable. We love you.
Thank you, Marlena. Appreciate the call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So it looks like we have time to get to this one, and I really love this because the Federal Trade Commission came down on Kellogg's for making inappropriate claims of health benefits for Rice Krispies and Frosted Mini-Wheats. Let's see, last July they got in trouble for the Frosted Mini-Wheats, and I'm quoting here what the ad said. I guess it was on the cereal box. Clinically shown to improve kids' attentiveness by nearly 20%. Who knew? Sugar. Wow, Frosted Mini-Wheats could make kids pay attention. Certainly goes against the anecdotal stuff I've heard. And they did have a clinical study. Here's how it worked. It was either eat nothing and be fasting and take a test of attention, or eat the Frosted Mini-Wheats and take a test of attention. There was no third group that actually had healthy food, like, say, some protein, and took the test. I'm sure they would have blown the pants off of the other two, but that wasn't the point of the study. I don't suppose the study was possibly funded by Kellogg's. In any event, they had a clinical study, but it didn't stand up to scrutiny. The other claims that they made on the Rice Krispies were, help support your child's immunity. The cereal has been improved to include antioxidants and nutrients that your family needs to help them stay healthy. In other words, they're putting actual food into the Rice Krispies. I guess that the interest of the population is to really be educated about nutrition and to be skeptical of advertising in grade school and junior high while their minds are still malleable. And I really think that's where we need to be targeting this. Waiting for the Federal Trade Commission to come down on Kellogg for misleading claims on cereal kind of misses the point. Health claims, inappropriate health claims, spurious health claims are everywhere, both in the food world, in the herb world. You've got to go beyond just reading the advertising. New and improved may be new, and improved is debatable. Bottom line here, folks, is that it shouldn't surprise anyone that Kellogg's is making these claims. And cereal is not, and I repeat, not Dr. Don's recommended breakfast. Ever, ever, ever. Even the best grain food in the world, which is steel-cut oats, can still raise blood sugar. It's still a grain. You want protein in the morning. Let me repeat that. When you're going to break your fast, you want protein in the morning. If you have a high carbohydrate breakfast, you will eat more for the whole next 24 hours. This has been shown again and again in real scientific studies. High carbohydrates in the morning equal a more difficult time losing or maintaining your weight. You've got to get protein in the morning. So let's go to Carol in Santa Cruz. Hello, Carol. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
I have, I believe, excess candida in my system, and I'm looking at ways to help myself.
Well, tell me about your symptoms, because you gave me a diagnosis that I don't necessarily accept.
Okay.
So tell me about your symptoms.
Tired all the time, insomnia, lots of joint pain, especially in my feet and knees and ankles and lower legs. Multiple food sensitivities, great sensitivity to carbohydrates.
What happens when you have carbohydrates? Do you bloat?
Well, yeah, and belching and a joint pain right away a lot of the time.
All right. So definitely something going on.
The insomnia, the fatigue.
Mm-hmm. How about rashes?
No.
Any itching around the anus?
Yeah, lots.
Okay.
And I used to get rashes from eating wheat. Great sensitivity to wheat and all kinds of grains and dairy products.
All right. So I think that your classic example of someone who fits the quote-unquote yeast syndrome.
Yeah.
But it's not really the yeast, in my opinion, that's causing the trouble. They're taking advantage of the situation, just like any life form will. If you have a wet, damp spot, you're going to get mold or an algae in it. Mm-hmm. If you have dysbiosis, which is, let's call it more characteristically, just an abnormal internal ecology of organisms living in your intestine, mm-hmm. one of the things that happens is that the good bacteria, which are commensals, they're helpful bacteria, are absent or else are present in very low levels. Mm-hmm. When they are absent or present in low levels, that's when yeast is able to thrive in your internal environment. So it's not necessarily the yeast that are causing all of your symptoms. It's an association, but not causality. And I think that's a really important distinction, because if you read the recommendations for systemic candidiasis, they are very, very restrictive. And I think too restrictive. You're supposed to avoid anything that's fermented, which I disagree with. You're supposed to avoid all starch, which I think is an excellent idea for dysbiosis, but particularly since you give a history of wheat sensitivity, there's a lot of cross-contamination. And you may actually have a problem by now with antibodies, not just against Candida, but also antibodies against wheat, against other food components that you've mentioned. And you may very well have bacteria that are growing very high in your intestinal tract in the small bowel. Early bloating after a meal is either carbohydrate malabsorption, in other words, you're not breaking down the carbohydrates or you're not digesting properly, or it's getting to bacteria which shouldn't be in that location high up in the small intestine, and they're just having a party on that carbohydrate and fermenting it. And that's where you're getting the gas and the bloating and the belching.
I am sensitive to all fermented products.
What about things like kimchi or sauerkraut?
Well, I've fermented my own vegetables. I haven't tried the kimchi.
Okay, because those contain actually beneficial bacteria.
Yeah.
And so we'd like to try to have you eating some fermented foods on a daily basis if we could. It would probably restore some of the health to your gastrointestinal tract. It sounds to me like you need a gut restoration program.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit too complicated to get into in great detail here.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of functional medicine doctors around. Are you local?
Yeah.
Okay. There are a number of doctors in town who do this work. I'm one of them, but there are others. You can go online to the Institute for Functional Medicine website and put in your zip code.
Okay.
And you should get some coaching on this, but you definitely don't have to just live a life of avoidance. There are things that you can put back in that will help restore you to a more normal functioning.
Okay. I went to an herbal store and they recommended fiber and for colon cleansing, along with a product called Enzylase, which is digestive enzymes. And then after using those for 10 days, something called Truflora, which is intestinal bacteria, I guess.
Well, those
Does
are
that
all...
sound like a good approach to do colon cleansing and then to do the probiotics?
I'm not a great fan of colon cleansing when it uses purgatives, so I think supporting is good.
It's guar gum.
Yeah, guar gum's not a very big deal. I suppose you can do that, but I don't know that it's all that helpful. Most of the authorities that I trust don't recommend colon cleansing as part of a gut restoration program. They don't feel it's been proven helpful. So, you know.
Well, I was questioning that, but that is standard.
Well, yeah,
herbal.
But you have to understand the education level and, you know, the training that the person at the herbal store has is all around the products that the herbal store has.
Yes, of course. But a lot of the books and articles and people that talk about candida talk about colon cleansing.
I know, but so I've already told you I don't think your problem's candida. I'm not sure that candida actually is the problem in most of the cases who have quote-unquote candida.
Yeah.
It just so happens that the measures that they're told to take coincide with a lot of the measures, but all it does is make the person well as long as they avoid those things and follow a very restrictive diet, but it doesn't heal them.
Right, and that's what I want to do. So where I should go is to this website for functional medicine?
That's where you should start, yeah. You're going to need some coaching, basically, is what I'm suggesting
okay,
you do.
Okay, how would I find the local doctors? Would they be on that website?
Yes.
And just look for functional medicine by Googling it?
Institute for Functional Medicine.
The Institute for Functional Medicine.
Yeah, if you put that in the Google, you'll come right up on it.
Okay, well, I really appreciate this. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
We have just a couple minutes, but let's go to John in Santa Cruz. Hello, John.
Morning. Thanks for the program. Great program. I just have a couple of questions I wanted to ask about. First, the hyaluronic acid substances that you hear on the radio, are they actually absorbable where you'll get any benefit from them?
The hyaluronic acid will be broken down into a component, and those components will be absorbed. You might get a little intact hyaluronic through, but most of it I think you'll get through as fragments. Those fragments will distribute to the areas of the body that are manufacturing glycosaminoglycans, and the fact that they're preformed will probably improve the efficiency of that process. So you might get a little bit more synovial fluid, a little bit more hyaluronic in your tissues that way. But it's not like analogous to putting it directly in.
Yeah.
We sometimes do injections where you're actually inserting it. What was your other question?
About my diet, most of my food intake is low fat, but I've been using a organic whole milk yogurt for my probiotics. And I just wondered if I'm okay with using that whole milk in terms of the fat and cholesterol content. Again, I don't use a lot of other high-fat. I don't eat a lot of meat or other high-fat foods.
Well, you're probably fine if you're not eating a lot of other high-fat foods. Some people who have genetic mutations will have a very high cholesterol regardless of what they eat. But it's simple enough to just continue what you're doing dietarily, and then when your annual exam rolls around, get a cholesterol test and see what your lipids are looking like.
Yeah, my cholesterol, I guess it's the total count is around 240.
I really care about the good cholesterol, bad cholesterol breakdown.
The good is high.
Your HDL is high.
Yeah.
Your total cholesterol divided by your HDL is under 4. Then you're fine.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Ask Dr. Don on KUSP is a program that we've been doing now for 12 years, and you can go to the website, askdrdon.com, and find, I think we've got back to 2004 or 2006, lots of old shows, lots of old topics, but I particularly want to pitch those interviews. There are wonderful interviews discussing a variety of functional medicine topics, so please go there and take a look. We've come to the end of another hour. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. This is Dr. Don saying so long, and stay healthy.